Stanford White, and John Jacob Astor, only to die destitute and penniless in his room at the New Yorker Hotel. This was the man, however, whose ideas the scientists at ARPA turned to when faced not only with the threat of the first Soviet Sputnik orbiting the Earth, but the even worse threat that the EBEs, seeing and hearing the Russian satellite, would be convinced that if the colonization of Earth was their goal, it was the Russians who would help them accomplish it. What was Tesla's idea? Consistently through the 1890s, Tesla wrote and lectured about his theory of the wireless transmission of electric current. Like Marconi's wireless radio, which revolutionized communication, Tesla's wireless electrical power supply would revolutionize the growth and development of entire cities, not just as an extrapolation of wireless power, but as a theory in its own right. Tesla reported that he had experimented with a beam of electrical energy directed without wires that could excite the atoms in a substance to the point where the substance, even though it could resist heat in conventional ovens, would break down. Such a beam weapon, Tesla said, would revolutionize warfare. In theory, at least, it was a very similar device, the laser cutting tool that the Army retrieval team picked out of the scrub at the Roswell crash site. One of the astounding aspects about the life and career of Nikola Tesla isn't just that he theorized about these projects. He actually experimented with them, many times succeeding in very intriguing ways, then patented the important inventions that derived from his experiments. But his ideas qua ideas were so radical for the time, so far ahead of anything his contemporaries were thinking, that they were dismissed as either the uncontrolled ravings of a mad scientist or so wildly impractical that they amounted to nothing. Yet, when you review the patents in his name, his descriptions of the systems he designed and the actual results of the public experiments or exhibitions he conducted, you find that even the most lunatic-sounding ideas, like his turn-of-the-century plans for vertical takeoff and landing bomber, actually looked as though they should work. In some cases, like his atom smasher, they worked better and more efficiently than the modern equivalents of these machines when they first appeared. When I realized that at the turn of the century, Tesla had actually demonstrated a model of a remotely piloted boat that could be controlled by radio from a distance and deliver torpedoes right into the heart of the enemy fleet, I was amazed that the Navy hadn't jumped on the idea in advance of World War I, and even more amazed that we hadn't ordered the design from Tesla in World War II when we knew the Germans were already experimenting with one. Yet today, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a remotely piloted vehicle similar in concept to the one Tesla had designed almost 100 years ago at less than 1/1000th of today's cost. And in 1915, Tesla had written to the U.S. War Department that in addition to his remotely piloted boat, they should urgently consider his remotely piloted aerial machines devoid of sustaining planes, wings, ailerons, propellers, and other external attachments, which will be capable of immense speeds and are very likely to furnish powerful armaments for peace in the near future. Such a machine, sustained and propelled entirely by reaction thrust rocket engines, can be controlled either mechanically or by wireless energy, radio controlled. Tesla's description of the remote-controlled rocket-powered guided missile, which was even more advanced than the German V-2, is the forerunner of today's modern ICBMs whose targeting information can be relayed to them after they're in flight. As a tactical weapon, Tesla had described over a half century earlier the Army's remotely piloted TOW anti-tank missile that destroyed Saddam's armored divisions in the Persian Gulf. Tesla's experiments with particle beam generation and direction were well underway during the 1890s when he was invited to set up an experimental station that would prove that he could transmit electrical power using the Earth's atmosphere as the medium instead of a heavy cable. If power could be so directed, Tesla's backers, who included industrialist George Westinghouse and financier J.P. Morgan, agreed it would revolutionize the infant electrical power industry and make whoever controlled the source of power rich beyond anyone's imagination. Tesla believed he could control that power, and with about $60,000 from his backers, travel to Colorado Springs, not coincidentally today's home to the Air Force North American Air Defense Command, NORAD, and the United States Army Space Command to build and demonstrate his power transmission station. Tesla described his experiments in an article he wrote for the 30th anniversary edition of The Electrical World and Engineer in 1904. He said, "Not only was it practicable to send telegraphic messages any distances without wires, as I recognized long ago, but also able to impress upon the entire globe the faint modulations of the human voice, far more still to transmit power in unlimited amounts to any terrestrial distance and almost without any loss." In Tesla's vision, electrical transmission stations would circle the planet, storing and relaying power from station to station so as to provide electrical power to the entire planet without the use of above or below ground power lines, feeder cables, and transmission lines. He also saw that a network of relay stations could receive and retransmit the world's breaking news stories instantly around the globe to pocket receivers, a cheap and simple device which might be carried in one's pocket, which would record special messages sent to it. Tesla had described the modern microwave cellular telephone and remote pager system. He also said that with relay stations like this, the entire Earth will be converted into a huge brain, as it were, capable of response in any one of its parts. In other words, an internet. During his time, Tesla truly made history by showing that energy could be directed as a beam without wires. In 1899, it was rumored that Tesla was experimenting with a death ray in Colorado Springs, but Tesla never owned up to it, and in fact remained uncommunicative about any experiments he had conducted with rays, even when English, German, Russian, and American scientists in the 1920s were applying for patents on the invention. In the 1930s, however, Tesla wrote in his monograph that he had made a new discovery that would make war obsolete because every nation would have the same power to destroy each other's military weapons. It would require a large facility to generate the power, but such a facility would be able to stop entire armies and their machines as far away as 200 miles in all directions. "It will," he wrote, "provide a wall of power offering an insuperable obstacle against any effective aggression." But it was not at all a death ray, he said, because scientists working as recently as the 1970s realized rays tend to diffuse over distance, and something is necessary to maintain the intensity of the focus. "Rather," he said, "my apparatus projects particles which may be relatively large or of microscopic dimensions, enabling us to convey to a small area at a distance trillions of times more energy than is possible with rays of any kind. Many thousands of horsepower can be transmitted by a stream thinner than a hair, so that nothing can resist." Although Tesla went on to describe how this beam will improve television transmission and the projection of images, he was really describing a directed, accelerated particle beam weapon that the folks at ARPA were struggling to develop over 25 years after Tesla first wrote about it and 11 years after the charred fragments of a directed energy apparatus as well as the laser tool were discovered in the wreckage of the spacecraft at Roswell, written up by the engineers at the Air Materiel Command and sequestered for years in my nut file. "We were still trying to develop a workable beam when I was at the Pentagon in 1962, and only barely developed a working model in the Reagan administration as part of the Strategic Defense Initiative program. But for Tesla, his world in the 1930s rushed towards war. Writing J.P. Morgan about his vision of an H.G. Wells nightmare of destruction of the civilized world through aerial bombardment, Tesla said that his particle beam weapon could shoot down airplanes in flight and so protect cities. He made proposals to the Russians to develop such a weapon because Stalin was afraid of an invasion from Japan. He also wrote to the British Prime Minister about the ability of his beam to protect London from attacks by the Germans. But no one thought his energy beam weapon practical, not even the Westinghouse Company, which, if they had advanced him the money to file for the patents they would probably have controlled, might have been able to develop the weapon before World War II had Tesla been able to complete it. As it was, Tesla's death ray, his accelerated particle beam in which subatomic particles were excited by an energy field and directed toward a specific target at speeds close to the speed of light, was never developed during his lifetime. However, the mere hint that Tesla's theories might have found their way to the Germans or the Russians so concerned the federal government, especially the FBI, that when Tesla died in January 1943, the FBI immediately seized all his papers, schematics, writings, and designs and turned them over to the Office of Alien Property, where they were officially sealed until released to the Yugoslavian ambassador, who was a representative of Tesla's estate. They remained in storage in Manhattan until the early 1950s, when they were returned to Yugoslavia. Yet even after their return, the Yugoslavian government believed that the FBI had rifled through Tesla's papers when they were in storage and had microfilmed them or photographed them. J. Edgar Hoover denied this, but photostatic copies of photographs of Tesla's papers were in the possession of the Army R&D's Foreign Technology Desk when I took over in 1961. How did they get there? Tesla's property was officially seized by the U.S. government 2 days after his death. Even though the FBI knew that Tesla had publicly said he'd perfected his death ray, there was no independent verification of this. No steps had been taken by the government to prevent him from transferring his plans for the death ray to foreign powers. Vice President Henry Wallace, however, told the FBI that the government had a critical interest in whatever papers Tesla had, and instructed the FBI to seize them any way they could. That was why the FBI directed the Office of Alien Property to enter Tesla's hotel room on January 9, 1943, and take possession. Tesla's other papers that were already in a storage warehouse were seized by the OAP as well. Over the next couple of weeks in January 1943, after a flurry of diplomatic activity between the Yugoslavian embassy and J. Edgar Hoover's office, the FBI turned the entire matter over to the Office of Alien Property, which also wanted to get out from under the diplomatic tug of war between Belgrade and the State Department. The OAP, still reacting to the vice president's instructions that papers that could give aid to the enemy could not leave the country, contacted the chairman of what would become the Office of R&D, the National Defense Research Committee of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, Dr. John Trump. Dr. Trump examined the papers, determined that not much of them were useful, but decided to make photocopies of a number of papers Tesla wrote during the years preceding his death. Trump also wrote abstracts of these papers, which included an undated monograph by Nikola Tesla entitled New Art of Projecting Concentrated Non-Dispersive Energy Through Natural Media. Tesla's description of how he would generate and direct a high-energy beam of electrons at a target. Though dismissed by Trump as unworkable, the paper nevertheless described Tesla's latest thinking about a directed energy weapon, the accelerated particle beam device. With the OAPs making photographs and abstracts of Tesla's papers, The entire Tesla property remained in storage until it was sent back to Belgrade in the 1950s. That should have put an end to the matter. However, in 1945, just after the war ended, the Air Technical Service Command at Wright Field outside of Dayton, Ohio, sought copies of the Tesla papers from the Office of Alien Property in Washington and sent a military courier to take possession of them and bring them back to Wright. Although there was some correspondence between the OAP and the Air Technical Service Command over the next 2 years regarding the disposition of the papers, at least one of General Nathan Twining's officers at the Air Materiel Command contacted the Office of Alien Property in November 1947 to tell them that the AMC at Wright Field had possession of the Tesla papers and would maintain possession of them at least until January 1, 1948. Thereafter, the papers, including Tesla's own monograph on his accelerated particle beam weapon, seemed to have completely disappeared, until they appeared in my OCRD files in 1961. But that was only one of the copies. At least one other copy of Tesla's monograph had remained in the possession of the working group under General Twining and had made its way to the Advanced Research Projects Agency in Washington over the course of the next 10 years. It was pulled out when the working group realized that upon the launch of Sputnik, the United States had absolutely no defense against war in space being initiated by the Russians, nor against the EBEs. We had one vital clue, however, about the only possible process that could interfere with the electromagnetic field drive we suspected the aliens were using, a directed particle energy beam weapon that could disrupt the electromagnetic wave formation around the spacecraft and penetrate the anti-gravity field. And we didn't even have to microwave the spacecraft by exciting the molecules in the composite material, because the accelerated particle beam weapon carried with it a powerful electromagnetic pulse. The effect of this EMP, the same effect that EMPs have on any electrical equipment, was to disrupt the anti-gravity field by destroying the integrity of the electromagnetic wave of the spacecraft. In this way, without exploding the spacecraft, the particle beam could force it to crash by destroying its ability to counter gravity. In its role as a more conventional weapon against incoming warheads or enemy satellites, besides destroying any electronics within the weapon through its electromagnetic pulse, the particle beam excites the atoms in the target, causes them to disperse, and the target explodes. In this way, the particle beam has a dual destructive capability. Tesla understood that the particle beam weapon was just like a bolt of lightning, with very much the same destructive power, only much more controlled. A lightning bolt is a massive beam of electrons. Scientists theorized that you can achieve the same destructive force with a beam of protons. Still, other scientists have argued that because electrons carry a negative charge and protons carry a positive charge, they are vulnerable to distortion within the Earth's magnetic field because the beam will either be attracted to the opposite charge or repelled by the same charge. In addition, a beam of like particles will contain a natural dispersive force because the like charges in a beam will repel each other. Entire hydrogen atoms are electrically neutral, however, and make a workable beam for any weapon designed to be used outside of Earth's atmosphere because neutral beams can be directed over very long distances that the beam from a space weapon will have to travel. Also, a neutral beam doesn't require the energy overhead to control dispersion because within a neutral beam, the particles are not charged and will not repel each other. Research and experiments on prototype models of a particle beam weapon conducted after 1980 define two basic types of weapons, those that will be used exclusively in space or exo-atmospheric weapons, and those that would be deployed on Earth against targets like incoming missile warheads. These are called endo-atmospheric weapons. Each has enough different characteristics to make them separate weapons, but the similarities of a particle beam weapon are common to both types. For example, as I began work on the development of basic research into particle beam weapons, my scientist told me that the weapon has to have 6 basic characteristics that allow it to kill the target. First, the beam must travel at such a high velocity near the speed of light that targets cannot evade it. Even UFOs travel slower than the speed of light, so that in a chase, the particle beam will always win. At the same time, the faster the beam travels, the shorter the burst you have in order for it to disrupt the target. Second, the beam has to stay on the target long enough for it to do its damage. We estimated that if we were bringing down an incoming enemy warhead, a powerful beam would disrupt the weapon's ability to detonate almost immediately and destroy it within a few seconds. In space, where distances are greater, the beam would have to stay on the target for a longer period of time, but it too would disrupt the wave propagation of the spacecraft after a very short interval. Even if it didn't destroy the spacecraft, it would certainly render it incapable of carrying out any offensive mission. Third, you have to be able to aim the beam immediately for it to have any effectiveness, especially if you're targeting an incoming multiple re-entry warhead vehicle, such as the type deployed by the Russians and us. Unless you took out the bus, the vehicle that carries and aims the separate warheads while still in orbit, you'd have to fire the beam at each of the separate vehicles very quickly in succession after they've split up in orbit and begun their separate re-entry trajectories. Thus, you'd have to aim and fire, aim and fire, aim and fire, all within a matter of seconds, making sure each target was destroyed. A single 50-kiloton detonation over New York City, for example, would paralyze the entire American financial industry and immediately change life as we know it for a considerable period of time. A multiple reentry vehicle launching 4 60-kiloton warheads from orbit on separate trajectories for detonation over Boston, New York, Washington, and Miami would cripple the United States for the ensuing 5 to 7 years, and the Russians wouldn't have to launch any such missile. It could easily come from China, North Korea, or even one of the Middle East fanatic terrorist countries like Libya with lots of oil money to spend. A particle beam weapon that could rapidly aim and fire to take out all 4 warheads either before or immediately upon reentry would effectively protect the United States and deter any country or terrorist group. Fourth, the beam must penetrate the surface of the target in order for it to cause any real damage to the mechanism inside the warhead. Therefore, one beam lands on the skin of the target. Its excitation of the target's molecules must take place not just on the outer hull or skin, but deep inside the vehicle's electronics. Therefore, even if it doesn't explode, it may either break apart into larger pieces or simply seize up and fall to Earth as a dud. Fifth, the particle beam must also be able to kill through its electromagnetic pulse, which will render the target's electronics inoperable by either throwing off its navigation or destroying its detonation program and turning it into a dud. Used as a space weapon, the electromagnetic pulse will have a similar effect upon enemy satellites, killing their control programs and rendering their computer guidance and orientation systems inoperable and blinding them completely. Upon enemy spaceships, the pulse would act as a purely defensive weapon that forces the ship to withdraw because its wave propagation device is rendered inoperable. And sixth, a particle beam weapon, unlike a laser, can operate in any weather and under any atmospheric conditions. Lasers bounce off clouds and fog and are weakened by anything less than perfectly clear weather. Particle beams penetrate and can operate under all conditions. As the scientists back in the 1950s evaluated what they would have to do to develop a working prototype, they understood the need for a huge power generator to accelerate the particles necessary to generate the beam, some form of target painting capability not only to acquire the target quickly and aim the weapon, but to re-aim in case the first shot is a miss. After I left the Pentagon, work continued on the theory underlying this type of weapon, but not much was done to assemble the very expensive supporting technologies such as the atomic particle accelerators, targeting computers, high-energy lasers, and a way to make the whole thing portable. Today, however, low-energy versions of these directed energy weapons, partly the great-grandchildren of the Tesla beam and partly the descendant of the directed energy apparatus from the Roswell craft, are currently on the market for installation in police cars, as a weapon against fleeing vehicles, as a way to shut down the high-speed chase before it even starts. The police officer in the pursuing vehicle aims his directed energy particle beam at the fleeing vehicle and turns it on. The electromagnetic pulse from the stream of electrons interferes with the target's ignition system in the engine, and the car, deprived of a flow of electrical power to fire the cylinders, rolls to a stop. No more high-speed chases on the 11 p.m. news, but a more effective and safer way to catch fleeing suspects in their own cars. This was a device developed by the military initially, and now deployed out of the Army Space Command as a missile-mounted kinetic energy beam for destroying enemy satellites, turned over to the law enforcement community. But its roots go back to the vision of Nikola Tesla and to what scientists believe to be the actual pieces of directed energy technology that we pulled out of the crashed space vehicle at Roswell, reports about which turned up in the nut file carted into my office in the Pentagon in 1961 from the Pentagon basement. For me, the irony has always been in the confluence between the historic work and discoveries of Nikola Tesla and the technology we ascertained the extraterrestrials had developed from our evaluation of the Roswell wreckage. Tesla had experimented with wireless transmission of energy, and the extraterrestrials seemed to have employed a type of wireless transmission of energy for navigational and defensive purposes. Tesla wrote about the theories behind the distortion or manipulation of a gravitational field through the propagation of electromagnetic waves, and the extraterrestrials seem to have employed just that kind of technology for a propulsion system. And Tesla's descriptions of the theories behind the death ray he claimed to have perfected ultimately became the basis for defensive weapons we deployed to challenge the hostile intrusions of our airspace by the extraterrestrials. What posed a threat to us at Roswell, and what we eventually learned from Tesla's writings, became two confluent streams of scientific theory that eventually became the basis of the Strategic Defense Initiative in anti-ballistic missile and space vehicle weapon. While scientists from the 1950s through the 1970s argued over the cost of such a weapon, and whether an anti-ballistic missile weapon would destabilize the otherwise stable world of mutual nuclear deterrence, others who understood the real threat from outer space argued there were enemies besides the Soviet Union who might someday acquire the technology to launch nuclear missiles against the United States. No one would dare say we had to defend ourselves against flying saucers. In fact, it wasn't until the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 that the particle beam weapon received another pulse of life as part of the hotly debated and ultimately successful strategy of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. Amid the guffaws from some political quarters and the hand-wringing from people who thought the thing simply cost too much, President Reagan managed to prevail. Just the strategy of Star Wars itself and the limited deployment and testing of some of the components were enough to put the United States on a wartime footing with the EBEs and show the Soviets that we finally had a real nuclear deterrent. The full story behind the SDI and the way it changed the Cold War and forced the extraterrestrials to change their strategies for this planet is a story that's never been told. But as spectacular and fantastic as it may sound, The story behind the limited deployment of the SDI is the story of how humanity won its first victory against a more powerful and technologically superior enemy who discovered, to whatever version of shock it experiences, that there was real trouble down on its farm. Chapter 17, Star Wars. Toward the spring of 1962, General Trudeau told me of his intention to retire. He was not going to be the commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam, he'd been told. The old man had charged up too many hills during his years in the Army, rifle in hand, and fired back in the face of the enemy. Whatever he felt inside him, and General Trudeau was only human and nothing more, he never showed fear. He was unrelenting in the execution of his orders, unyielding when people opposed him, and he never ducked away from a fight. Those who knew him either respected or feared him, but they never discounted him. A West Point graduate, he was born into a generation of U.S. military officers who had absolutely no doubt about what was right and what was wrong. And he marched through two wars and a series of commands, including the head of U.S. Army intelligence, secure in the knowledge that he was on the right side. These were great qualities in a wartime commander. But, as both General Trudeau and I found out, they could be the very things that make you vulnerable in a Cold War army of politicians angling for power as they fought an enemy who could not be seen and whose presence was only indirectly felt. "There are no more pork chop hills, Phil," General Trudeau told me after he had learned that General Maxwell Taylor, with the support of the Army leadership, had passed him over for the South Vietnam Command. It meant that this was his last command, and he would retire as a lieutenant general. "And I'm afraid this is a war the Army's going to fight by means of a political process instead of on the killing field." "We would win it if we were going there, General," I said, fury welling up inside my chest. "You and I know what we learned in Korea." Maybe the general could see my face getting flushed because he said, "No. We probably would have gotten court-martialed because of what we learned in Korea. Just think what they would do to us if we were to win the war." Then he laughed in a way that told me he was looking forward to his retirement. "We would have made the communists look bad. You know we can't do that, Phil." Even as we were speaking that afternoon toward the end of the summer, another Soviet trawler was heaving to at the entrance to the port of Havana, awaiting instructions for the offloading of its cargo, while another one of our surveillance planes was circling high overhead, snapping away its photos of the tarpaulins coming off the IRBMs laid out on the ship's after deck. I didn't know it yet, but a sequence of events was unfolding that would swirl me into one of the biggest controversies of my life, just as the chilling truth about the attempt to colonize our planet and the harvesting of human beings and animals that were still going on made itself all too clear. A showdown was coming. It was just over the horizon. No one could see it, but a handful of us knew that something was stirring the waters just below the surface. General Trudeau was saying his goodbyes and started counting the days until he would change his uniform for civilian clothes and his office in the Pentagon for a corporate executive suite that befitted his experience as the commanding officer of some of our military's most important divisions. He had been at the helm of R&D for 6 years, after having commanded Army intelligence for 3 years before that. Although the general didn't explicitly comment much on the incredible facts we had uncovered in the Roswell file because he considered it part of his job, he did joke about it from time to time with his old friend, Senator Strom Thurmond. More than once, I would take the back door into his inner office only to find Senator Thurmond and General Trudeau sitting on his couch and looking me up and down as I walked in. "Art," Senator Thurmond would drawl, barely hiding his Cheshire Cat smile. "What spooky things you thinking old Phil's been up to?" You been inside your junk file, Phil? The general would ask.
I would guess. You're probably able to tell the future, Phil, Senator Thurman said. With what you're reading, you can predict anything.
Just acting like a good intelligence officer, Senator, I said, being as correct and noncommittal as possible in the presence of my commanding officer. My job is to read intelligence and make analyses.
Well, they ain't got nothing on you, Phil, the senator said, and everybody in the room knew exactly what they meant, even if we weren't allowed to talk about them in public.
As for me, I was preparing my files for General Beach, the incoming chief of research and development, knowing that my own retirement would come at the end of 1962. So I would prepare to go silent about Roswell while setting up a run of about 6 months to push as many projects through as I could, including whatever was left in my nut file. Only I didn't call it a nut file or anything after General Trudeau left. My new boss and I had a tacit agreement not to broadcast anything about Roswell or the files. As the summer of 1962 came to an end, ominous reports were circulating all through Washington concerning Soviet freighters making their way into Cuban waters. The traffic was intense, but there was no response from our intelligence people on what was happening. The CIA was completely mum, and the word making its way through the Pentagon was that we were getting slapped around by the Soviets and were going to sit still for it. Whatever it was, friends of mine in Army intelligence were saying the CIA was going to downplay it because the Kennedy administration didn't want a confrontation with the Soviet Union. What was it? I kept asking, knowing all the while that the Soviets must have been playing around with something in Cuba, and that's why there were so many ships. Were they massing troops there? Was it a series of military exercises? My answer came in a shocking series of photographs, unmistakable surveillance photographs that were leaked to me by my friends at the Office of Army Intelligence so deep inside the Pentagon, and so secret you weren't even allowed to take notes inside the room. I was asked by officers, who may still be alive and therefore shall go unnamed, to take a good look at the photographs they had developed from the spy planes over Cuba. They said, "Memorize these, Colonel, because nobody can make any copies here." I couldn't believe my eyes as I looked down at the glossies and then ran a magnifying glass over them just to make sure that I wasn't seeing things. Nope, there they were, Soviet intermediate-range ballistic missiles of the latest vintage. These babies could take out Washington in just minutes, and yet they were sitting outside of hangars only a few miles from our Marine base at Guantanamo Bay. Had General Curtis LeMay seen these photos, I had to ask myself? LeMay, a veteran of Korean bombing runs, should have been drooling over his desk at the prospect of bombing the hell out of Castro just for thinking he could even park IRBM so close to U.S. airspace. Yet no reaction from Washington at all. The Army had nothing to say. The Air Force had nothing to say. And my Navy friends were simply unresponsive. Somebody was putting the lid on this, and I was getting deeply worried. So I called one of my friends, New York Senator Kenneth Keating, and asked him what he knew.
"What do you mean, missiles, Colonel Corso?" he asked. "What missiles? Where?"
It was October 1962.
"In Cuba, Senator," I said. "They're sitting in Cuba waiting to be deployed on launchers, don't you know?"
The truth was Senator Keating did not, nor did Representative Mike Fagan, whom I also called. Both legislators knew better than to ask me where I found the photos or who gave them to me, but before they did or said anything, they wanted to know why I believed them to be authentic. "They come from our best sources," I told them. "I could pick out the missiles myself. I know what they look like. And it's not just a single photo, but a series over weeks of tracking the delivery of them on the decks of Soviet freighters. They're unmistakable, very damning." Senator Keating asked whether I knew for sure that President Kennedy had been informed of the presence of the missiles, but I told him there was no way of knowing. Privately,
I would have been shocked if intelligence sources had kept this information away from the president, because there were so many intelligence pathways to the Oval Office, the president would have found out no matter who tried to keep the information away. So it was pretty clear to me that the administration was trying to keep the news from the American people so that neither the Russians nor the Cubans would be embarrassed and have their backs against the wall. I also knew that by going to Senator Keating and Representative Fagan, I was taking a huge risk. I was leaking information outside the military and executive chains of command to the legislative branch. But that same April, I had already testified to Senator Dirksen's committee on the administration of the Internal Security Act that it was my belief, and I had proof to back it up, that our own intelligence services, particularly the Board of Estimate, had been penetrated by the KGB. And as a result, we lost a war in Korea that we should have won. The testimony was regarded as classified and was never released. But it made its way to Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who promised me in a private interview at the Justice Department that he would personally make sure his brother, the president, read it. Now here it was, a little more than 6 months later, and whatever intelligence information the president was getting about a serious Soviet threat to U.S. security, it was clear that unless somebody stopped them, the Russians were going to get away with it. Not on my watch. President Kennedy had gone up to Hyannisport, and the vice president, Lyndon Johnson, a friend of Ken Keating's from his days as Senate Majority Leader, was completely out of the decision-making loop within the White House. The rumors were that because of his association with Bobby Baker, there was going to be an investigation of the vice president, and he might not return as a member of the ticket in 1964. So Senator Keating didn't recommend going to Lyndon Johnson with this information. Besides, we had to get it right in front of the public so it couldn't be swept away, leaving the White House free to ignore it until it was too late to force the Soviets' hand. This was a gamble, of course, because the whole world could explode in our faces, but I knew that the only way to deal with the Russians was to put their noses in it and teach them a lesson. Had we done that in Korea the way MacArthur wanted to, there probably would not have been a Vietnam War. One of my friends in the Washington Press Corps was Paul Scott, the syndicated political columnist whose pieces appeared in the Boston Globe and the Washington Post. If we gave him the story, it would find its way into the Globe and the Post at the same time, right in the president's face, and forcing him to act. I didn't enjoy this, but there was no other way. So Senator Keating, Mike Fagan, and I coordinated the strategy. I called Scott and told him I had seen some photos and had an interpretation he needed to hear. We met, not at the Pentagon, and I described to him the copies of the photos that I had seen and explained in very general terms and without revealing anything classified about our surveillance apparatus, how they were taken, why they were authentic, and what they meant. You understand that when I saw these cylinders, I said to him, drawing on a notepad the tiny barrels in the photos on the deck of his ship, these are intermediate-range ballistic missiles that can hit Washington, New York, or Boston within 15 minutes after launch. We can't even detect these babies until they're just below orbit and coming down. That gives us maybe 5 minutes to get under our desks. But with nuclear warheads on them, anybody sitting anywhere near where they detonate is not going to be protected. What's the point? He asked. Why would the Cubans want to get into a war with the United States? It's not the Cubans, I explained. It's Soviet blackmail. They're not going to turn a bunch of missiles over to Fidel Castro and put the trigger for a nuclear warhead in somebody else's hand. The Soviets will have complete control. They'll have their own troops on the island, and they'll threaten to launch them if we or anybody else tries to throw Castro out. Why are you telling me this? He asked. Because, I said, hoping for a sense of outrageous indignation in him that would motivate him to action, the president already knows and won't do anything about it. I was right. The newspaper man was in shock. He half suspected that Kennedy wanted to avoid any and all confrontation until he made it to his second term, but this was outright capitulation, he said. He can't get away with it!
Oh, yes he can, I warned him, and if we don't get the story out, it goes away. The president's sticking his head in the sand and hoping nobody pulls it out. You have to run this in the Globe right when he's in Massachusetts and force him to confront it. He flies back to Washington, and it's in the Post. Then the Soviets know that he knows, and it's all a complete mess.
But what if this sets off a war, Scott said.
Over Cuba?
Listen, not even Khrushchev's own people are willing to sacrifice Moscow for Havana, I told him. It's a Russian gambit, because the KGB told Khrushchev he could get away with it. He's punishing us for the U-2 in the Bay of Pigs. We have to stand up to the Russians right here and now, because if we don't, the Cold War's over and we lost. It's all about territory, and if we don't defend our own hemisphere, we lose. And if we make them back down, humiliate them, we win. The story ran in the Boston Globe and the Washington Post within days, forcing the president back to Washington to confront a crisis that would go down in history as one of the defining moments of the Kennedy administration. Robert Kennedy knew that the White House was getting faulty intelligence from the CIA, and John Kennedy knew that he had to strike a middle course between the CIA people, who told him everything would be okay if he let Khrushchev off the hook, and his own Air Force chief, Curtis LeMay, who wanted him to invade Cuba. Very wisely, Kennedy didn't invade Cuba. He also didn't back down, at least in public. Our blockade of Cuba turned the Russian Navy around and humiliated Nikita Khrushchev, whose gambit had failed. President Kennedy traded off some obsolete missiles in Turkey to give Khrushchev something he could take back to the Kremlin. But we knew all along that when we deployed our Polaris submarines in the Mediterranean and North Seas, we'd have more firepower packed and ready to go against the Soviets than we ever had in Turkey, and the Soviets wouldn't even know it was there. Besides, we knew the Turks would never let us fire our missiles against the Russians from their soil. They were afraid the Russians would use the missiles to attack Turkey, but the Kremlin knew that too, and knew we wanted an excuse to get out of Turkey graciously. So it worked all the way around, and President Kennedy got the bragging rights to drawing a line right across the ocean where the Russian Navy could not cross, firing a shot across their bows in the open ocean and making them turn around in open water and sail back home. Before the whole world, the Russians had backed down. President Kennedy was a hero. But I had made some powerful new enemies and could see the end of my own career in the Army like a distant sign on an empty expressway coming up at 80 miles an hour that reads, Freeway Ends. I now devoted myself to packing away the Roswell files for those whom they would go to after me and writing my own notes for the work that I might find myself in after I left the Army. Who could have realized that within months I'd be sitting in an office on Capitol Hill, looking across the desk at one of my own successors who was there as the scientific advisor to the Secretary of Defense? I may have stepped on the toes of some of the most powerful people in Washington, but it was still the good fight, and I was, above it all, still a soldier in the Cold War and still fighting the stealth war against the strategies of the EBEs, who were becoming more aggressive in their appearance over defense installations, cities, and our manned and unmanned space probes. Even the Russian intelligence services had begun to complain about the mysterious goings-on with their space probes, but they wouldn't come right out and tell us the reasons why. We had to figure those out for ourselves. If the Cold War sounded complex and chaotic in the early 1960s, as Kennedy juggled the strategies of Truman and Eisenhower while recognizing that he couldn't trust his own intelligence services, imagine what it was like when you factored in the other Cold War, or as some have called it, the real Cold War against the extraterrestrials. It was becoming like the elephant in the room that everybody knows is there but keeps denying it. Its presence is so massive that you have to walk around it. Its trunk swings with such a force that you have to duck when it sweeps over your head. Watch out that the big elephant feet don't crush your toes when he plants them, and you don't want to step too close to the elephant's backside lest you get buried in what comes out. In other words, dealing with the Soviets was just a big mess that we had to accommodate while we all sat down at the same dinner table. The Soviets and the Americans pretending to break bread while not blowing up the world. Yet each of us looking for the advantage while we watched one another's hands the entire time. You watch your enemy's hands, he watches your hands, and whatever you can do with your feet, you do. Meanwhile, your enemy's doing the same thing. The Army's hands were tied by the cover-up. The refusal of the government to let us take on the alien threat with our full resources because we had to pussyfoot around the truth. But more than a few congressmen knew about the cover-up were as concerned as we were about the intrusions of the EBEs, the human abductions, and the cattle mutilations, and supported the military's agenda for a program of speeded weapons development in space. We were convinced that whoever the extraterrestrials were, they were tampering with our planet, operating with impunity, and manipulating us constantly and secretly. But it was a secret that had our full compliance because we were unwilling to admit the truth and fight the war. Those of us in the military who knew it was happening also felt that we could be experiencing an invasion that was more of an infiltration. They were compromising our very systems of defense and government, I suggested, and then, by the time the conflict opened up, we would already be open and vulnerable. If the EBEs had been around long enough, I once suggested to General Trudeau, might they have seen the Trojans towing that huge wooden horse the Greeks left for them right through the open gates of the city? For his part, General Trudeau, in the months before he retired, made a number of appearances before Congress. He argued consistently that the Army did have a real place in space, and we had a capability in missile defense that he had proven at Los Alamos and at the guided missile and Redstone Command at Huntsville, Alabama. Moreover, the Army had been able to use German scientists in the months immediately after the fighting in Europe had ended. It wasn't just a matter of who could get the biggest budget, General Trudeau testified. In fact, he offered in a briefing before the Congressional Committee on Science and Astronautics, if the space effort was to be completely taken away from the Army, then it should be given lock, stock, and barrel to the Air Force. At least, he said, the Air Force was a military service and had officers and enlisted personnel who knew how to fight. But at least in the early years, Congress and the President decided that NASA should control the space program. By the end of the 1960s, however, they had reversed that decision and realized there was a serious military aspect to space exploration. General Trudeau also had his allies among the major defense contractors we worked with. Not only scientists, but members of the boards of directors suspected that the Army had an urgency in developing weapons for use in space. Some of them even realized that we must have had a hidden agenda because each of the projects we proposed, like Horizon and the energy weapons, seemed designed for a war with enemies far more powerful and elusive than the Soviets. When he would address industrial groups on matters of technical intelligence and applied engineering, General Trudeau received what I could only call a knowing response. He himself once wrote in his unpublished memoirs that when he was invited to give an address to one of the companies we work with, the people who showed up were the decision makers. He said, "I think on every occasion that I went out, the chairman of the board was there, the chief executive officer, who was usually the president, and an impressive cross-section of their senior corporate officers or directors. I might say, even when I went to Sperry Rand, no less a person than General MacArthur honored me by his presence at dinner, and he didn't turn out for many." General Trudeau was the father of the ballistic missile and the person who, from the 1950s through the 1960s, made sure that our armed forces adapted the ballistic missile for our own use. His presence at Sperry Rand with MacArthur, his boss in Korea, was all the more important because General MacArthur knew the truth about UFOs and commented that the Army was girding itself for a fight in space. And he didn't mean fighting the Russians in space. He meant the extraterrestrials. But we were fighting so deeply immersed in the darkness of our own official denial that the fantastic nature of the truth, the ongoing effects of the truth, and the capitulation of the civilian intelligence services to some crazed blueprint they had for world order based upon an international government sometimes made us doubt our own senses. However, when you looked at what I called the secret history of the United States since 1947, you knew that the invisible elephant was walking through the room. A better analogy is the concept of the black hole. Black holes, the ultra-dense remains of stars that have collapsed upon themselves, swallowed up light and gravity, and compressing them in a galactic compactor like something that only subatomic particle physicists can describe and that can't actually be seen. Only their effects can be determined from the way light and gravity seems to behave around them. So you guess that a black hole might be present in a specific region of space when light and gravity around it bend, almost like the way water circles around the drain at the bottom of your sink. That's what the truth looked like in the region around our Cold War strategy and the development of any ultra-high-tech or exotic weapons. It might have made sense in 1947, but by 1962, the refusal of the government to admit the war it was fighting was getting in the way of actually fighting the war. Since 1947 and the formation of the working group, each new layer of bureaucracy operating within the black hole of UFO strategy and intelligence gathering found itself more enmeshed in the confusion of what was true and what was false than the previous layer. Like legions of blind soldiers, they bumped into one another in the night, upset one another's plans, and thought that friends were foes and vice versa. In the absence of a clear policy that could be maintained from generation to generation, the strategy for dealing with the EBEs became tangled up in its own web. After December 1947, when General Hoyt Vandenberg, the Air Force Chief of Staff, directed the Air Force to evaluate and track UFO sightings, this in response to the working group, Project SIGN began at the Air Technical Intelligence Center. SIGN was so critical that even J. Edgar Hoover in 1947 issued Bureau Bulletin 59, ordering that all future reports of UFOs should not be investigated by FBI agents but sent instead to the Air Force. Although officially not looking for UFOs, the Air Force Project SIGN examined 243 sightings and submitted its report in February 1949. But at the same time SIGN was doing its evaluation, the Air Technical Intelligence Center issued its own document called An Estimate of the Situation. Basically, but naively, the document came to the conclusion that we were dealing with extraterrestrial interlopers who were observing us from UFOs. But General Vandenberg, in the words of one of the officers I later ran into at the Pentagon, had a cow and not a mutilated one. "Colonel," this officer said, "steam was coming out of the old man's ears, he was so furious. Just be glad you weren't there." So I asked this officer why General Vandenberg was so steamed. After all, he ordered the report in the first place. Why didn't he just agree with General Twining and Admiral Hillenkoetter to ask the president to begin releasing the information? "Are you crazy?" this officer said. The year was 1956. And I had been sent over from the White House for a briefing at the Pentagon. "Don't you remember what happened when the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast was on the radio? We had near riots in the cities because they thought the thing was real. Can you imagine what would happen if it really happened, if our own government said that flying saucers had landed just like on the radio, only this time we caught one and they're still coming back? Think about it. Riots, looting, people going insane because they thought the aliens were destroying the planet." He was right. And what was worse, the aliens were setting up for some sort of hostile act, whatever it was. When General Vandenberg read the estimate of the situation, he fumed and ordered the whole report burned to ashes before anyone else could read it. It was one of the last official government assessments of the UFO situation ever to get close to being distributed before the real cover-up clamped down. But the grumblings about the